My intent today is to begin with Sergio Furio from Brazil. Sergio, are you on the call?
Yes, I'm here.
Perfect. Well, Sergio is the founder and CEO of Creditas. This name, Creditas, is new. I think it's only been a few weeks that this name has come about. You may have read my story on Sergio's company under the company name Bank Fácil. So, Sergio, tell us about Bank Fácil, which you're now calling Creditas. What do you do?
Yes, so first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity of sharing our story. So basically, Creditas is a digital lending platform. We focus on secured loans, so that means basically home equity loans and auto equity loans. Our mission is to reduce the huge interest rates that Brazilians are paying to the traditional players by, you know, disrupting the market through technology and the usage of this innovative product in this country.
So this stuff is not where you started. Tell us a bit about where you started and how you, you know, what did you learn from the market? What caused you to pivot out of your original hypothesis to this one? Take us a bit through your journey.
So the story is, well, basically originally I'm Spanish. I moved to New York in 2008, spent like 4 or 5 years in New York, working in strategy consulting for retail banks. By 2011, I was already sick of it, if you want, and I was looking for opportunities in the fintech space. I got to know the Brazilian specific problem, which basically is a huge banking spread between, you know, what investors get paid for the money and what borrowers pay for the debt. So basically, in the U.S., they would have like a borrower borrowing money for like 10% or something, and then investors getting a 1% for the money. That's like a 9% spread, if you want, or a you know, personal loan or something. In Brazil, basically, investors get paid a 5% and borrowers pay a 200%. So the original idea was there needs to be like a better way of managing this process of you know, the acquisition process of new customers. There's definitely like an issue with financial education. So the original idea was to create sort of like a bank rate type of model or money supermarket, sort of like a lead generation company, delivering education to the common Brazilian, and then you know, with a lot of emphasis on organic traffic and the like, and then taking those potential leads and directing them to the banking industry. So what we realized very quickly, and actually, well, it may take us like it probably took us like 9 months or something, was that in reality the problem was not in acquiring customers. The problem was more in actually converting customers. It was not on the marketing component of the operation. It was more on the processing and on the efficiency of the conversion funnel. So what we did was we completely changed the approach of our business from being a horizontal marketing model to being like a totally verticalized lending platform, and focusing on the very, you know, the very biggest problem that you may have, which is you know, reducing those spreads and making sure that Brazilians were paying a lower rate. So we started at the beginning by partnering with traditional players, and instead of just generating the lead, processing the loan, and actually doing the underwriting process of the loan, but then having them taking the risk and so on, and then progressively we start like moving more and more through the value chain until today, in which we issue our own funds, we fundraise money that we put into the platform, do the processing of the loans, do the collection of the loan, and so on. So we started by partnering with the banks, and we ended up being a partner and the same time, and a competitor as well, right? So actually, since you mentioned it before, yeah, I was going to say, since you mentioned it before, so the reason for changing the name from Bank Fácil to Creditas was that originally the idea of Bank Fácil was to have like a better way of interacting with the banks, right? Like an easy way of interacting with the bank. And now we have like nothing to do with that. We are like a credit company, and that's why we moved into Creditas.
Now, there was a core insight that you had in coming up with your, you know, strategy, which is around home ownership in Brazil and using home equity as collaterals, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you talk about that?
So just for context of the audience, so Brazil is like a it has like a $500 billion in lending to individuals, $500 billion. That compares to the U.S. where you have like $13 trillion or something, right? So relatively small compared to the U.S. in terms of amount of credit for the individuals, but at the same time the spread, the margin was astonishingly high. So on average, the margin in the for this lending is a 40%, 4-0 spread. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. Compared to the U.S., where probably you have like something like a 2 or 3%, no more than that, right? So even though you have like a 10 times less credit, you have like 10 times more margin. So in reality, the size of the revenue pool is pretty much the same as the one that you could have in a huge economy like in the U.S. So what actually happened was that we started like looking at why was it that that consumers were paying so high, and what we realized was that they were basically focusing on unsecured loans. So they were taking money in a very short term and very high interest rate. So that was overdrafts, revolving credit cards, personal loans, priced at above 200%. We dig a little bit like deeper and looked at those customers, and what we realized was that they were like homeowners and car owners. And the thing was that when we were going like deeper and deeper, we saw that 70% of the residences in Brazil have no debt whatsoever, and so no mortgage, and 70% or 75% of the car fleet has no debt either. So there's not like an auto loan. And the rationale behind this was that 10 years ago, you didn't have a long-term capital market. So from a banking perspective, it didn't make sense to move into lending for the long term, right? So what we did was say, okay, so this looks like promising. We launched in the market the first digital platform that was focusing on using those residences and those cars as a collateral for a much cheaper lending products, so basically we just focused on that thing now.
Yep. Now, you managed to bootstrap this company for some distance such that you could attract some seed capital. Talk to us about that very early stage of business building and validation. What were you able to do to be able to attract some amount of seed capital?
So in the early days, it was like a pretty crazy thing. So I was like a strategy consultant by myself, and definitely the last thing that I did was like thinking about the strategy too much. I just like jumped into execution very quickly. The business model, as we were saying before, it was like not robust at all. So I spent like, originally I was expected to spend like 12 months for the first fundraising. It ended up being like 18 months for the first fundraising. So I was like running out of money, sold my apartment in New York just to make sure that I had like some cash just in case of. But what we realized was that the investors didn't like the model because the conversion funnel in Latin America in general, and probably in most of the emerging markets, is so unattractive. So the efficiency of a lead, from lead to closing, is so low compared to more developed markets that the value of the lead doesn't pay off, right? Ultimately what was going on there, and the reason why we were not able to attract investors in the early days, was that we didn't have a model. It didn't make sense. So the secret sauce was let's find an actual problem that we can solve end-to-end with attractive unit economics. And from that perspective, verticalization was a must. So once we identified the problem, it was all about putting together the unit economics of our type of business, going to the investors, automatically like was much easier than before. So I guess that the takeaway from that is fundraising in emerging markets, at least in Latin America, much more difficult if you don't have like a clear case on your business model, then dramatically more simple when actually the business kicks in and you have like some nice metric to show. So basically our funding story was we were funded in April 2012. The seed capital came in October 13. Then we did a Series A between 15 and 16. That was in total $7.5 million. And then mm-hmm. we just closed last week our Series B that were $19 million. And that was just a week ago.
So let's talk about the period between your seed and Series A. So 2013, you closed your seed, and in 15, you said you closed your Series A?
Yeah, that's it. So that was basically 18 months.
Yeah. 18 months. And what were the milestones of those 18 months? What did you accomplish in those 18 months?
Yeah, so we started, when we raised the seed capital, basically we were still in the lead generation business. We didn't mm-hmm. have a platform that was able to actually process the loans. We just had a platform to generate leads. We had a good traffic in October 13. We had a good traction, mm-hmm. but no lending platform. So the milestone that we actually worked like crazy to attain during 2014, that was basically the whole effort and the whole investment of the seed was to actually create a platform that was able to process the loans. It didn't have to do the underwriting because the underwriting just came in 2015 and 16, but the processing mm-hmm. of the loan was the critical milestone. So by a year after the seed capital, we already had the processing workflow, and the metrics were pretty good. So we just with a couple of pages, we just went and started pitching to probably a group of 10 investors, no more than that. And in mm-hmm. a month, we got the term sheet. So I would say that the milestone was building the processing platform. And proving that the metrics were already paying off at that point.
So when you raised the seed money, did you tell your investors that you were going to move in the direction of actually processing loans?
That's a good question. So I would say that from a history perspective, in the early days we were trying to shoot for the moon, so we were trying to do everything at the same time. So we wanted to go vertical and horizontal at the same time, right? So mm-hmm. we wanted to still remain multi-product, doing not just credit but also credit cards and even insurance, yeah. and even flirting with investments and so on. And at the same time, mm-hmm. we were also telling the seed investors that we had the opportunity to do verticalization. So I think that looking backwards, it was a very naive approach that you can do with you with just $1 million that you can do the entire thing. It definitely didn't happen. So we told them that we were going to build a processing platform, but we told them that we were going to build 10 more things. And thanks God, we ended up just focusing on processing. And then when we reached the seed, then everything was clear at that point.
So, one thing that strikes me, Sergio, is the problem with the emerging markets, especially where things are or where things have been in the last, 5-7 years, is that the market is not only full of first-time entrepreneurs, it's also full of very naive investors. Somebody who has seen a few cycles on the investment side would have probably been able to guide you better and tell you that you shouldn't be doing all these different things. Just choose one thing and do that one thing. $1 million is a little bit of money. It's not that much money to do that many things.
Yeah, so I have a slightly different perspective that I would like to share with you. So in reality, I think that everyone was advising us not to do that thing. But we just thought that we were smarter than them. So in reality,
I think that they, so you were not listening.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say, a self-criticism, I was simplifying the whole reality and saying, no, obviously we're going to be able to do this entire thing. I mean, it's just tweaking a couple of things here and there. So definitely I wasn't one that was being naive more than the investors at that point. I think that, in reality, I think that the, you know, in Brazil, I would say that the biggest difference between a seed investor in Brazil and a seed investor in developed markets is the seed investor in Brazil, they like to see some revenue, they like to see some good unit economics. They are not willing to take the risk of, you know, the product market fit type of thing, and, you know, maybe this thing never generates a dollar in revenue and so on. So I think that's the biggest difference.
But this is true nowadays. Nowadays in the U.S. also, that is true. In Europe, it is true. And primarily, it is true these days because a lot of companies are bootstrapping to a certain level of validation. So the seed investors have the option of investing in validated companies versus not validated companies. And as an investor, you know, you would always go with stuff that are less risky and more validated. That's just how the market operates.
Yeah, I guess so. That was like 4 years ago, probably in the U.S. it was like much easier to raise funds at that point. But, you know, if I think in retrospective, I think I was not ready yet. That was the reality. I was like a first-time entrepreneur with a not very clear vision on where the business were heading to, not a very clear view on the business model. So I got like so many no's for like 9 months or something that, you know, thanks God that in 14 we just focused on what actually mattered, which was like creating the business.
Yeah. Now, in between Series A and this round, which is, I imagine, your Series B, right? The 19.5 million in Series B. What were the levers that really helped you get, you know, much further in the business?
Yeah, so obviously traction needs to be into the equation. So definitely we were growing fast for our type of business. So as a reminder, secured lending tends to be like a much less scalable business because of the complexity of the processes, the appraisals, you know, the formalization and so on. But we were growing like we were tripling on a year-on-year basis, and we were even more than that on a revenue basis. So definitely traction was like a relevant factor, but more important than that, we have finalized the verticalization process. When we reached the Series A, we had like a platform for doing the processing of the loan. When we have reached Series B, we are like a full platform that was not only doing the underwriting of the loan and the formalization of the loan, but it was also doing servicing. And we were actually even creating our own vehicles to do the investment and connecting directly to investors instead of going through financial institutions, right? I think that the degree of freedom that we have today compared to what we had in Series A was an order of magnitude bigger, just because we are sort of like owners of our destiny. I believe that the investor looks at the company that can grow by itself, regardless of what happens in the economy, especially in this in the current scenario in Brazil with the economy in a 3-year recession. So I think that's like a critical point in which it adds tons of validation, both to have like traction and at the same time a control on the entire value chain.
Now, when you raised Series A, you said it was a very fast process. You only talked to about 10 investors in Brazil, and you were able to close the deal in 1 month. Talk to us a little bit about the scenario in, you know, the venture capital scenario in Brazil. You know, what are the key trends and learnings that you can share?
Yeah, so the situation in Brazil has changed dramatically in the last since we started until now. So 4 years ago, Series A was not the market for Series A probably was not that liquid, and for seed it was like a mess. It really there weren't like a seed funds or an ecosystem for angel investing and so on. Even the entrepreneurial ecosystem has dramatically improved. So if I look at today the startup ecosystem, so you have a bunch of accelerator programs, you have tens of angel investing groups. I'm the board member of the HBS Angel Investors here in Brazil. It's a group of like very active 60 to 70 investors and so on. for seed money, it's a great time to be in the country. There's like quite a lot of liquidity. There's like a bunch of people that is willing to put on like a, let's say like a $250,000 check, $500,000 check to kick off your business. On Series A, you have basically probably like a group of between 5 and 10 funds that are focused on that specific segment. I would say that there are like three specifically. There are like the market references. One is local, which is Monashees. They have been around for like probably like a decade or so, and there are like there are another two that are international. One is a Red Pointy Venture, which is a joint venture between two Silicon Valley funds, Red Point Ventures and E Ventures. So they created a $130 million fund back in 2012 or 13 or something, and they are one of the three references again. And then the third one is Casec Ventures, which is from the founders of Mercado Libre, one of the most successful cases in Latin America, I would say. So those three guys are, you know, typically writing checks between, $2 and $5 million for Series A's, which is like the typical Series A in Brazil. And then you have like another, you know, as I was saying, 6, 7, maybe even 10 additional funds that act either as leaders of slightly smaller rounds or as a participants in a $4 to $5 million Series A, right? So for Series A, I think that liquidity is pretty good these days. You know, good business gets funded as always. Bad business, they may have like some difficulties as probably always.
As they should.
So that's for Series A. We are seeing some international, like pure international investors also looking at Series A. An example of that is Sequoia. They made the first investment in the region in 2013 with Nubank, which now is like the success story in Brazil. It's almost like it's getting to a unicorn right now in dollar terms. And they made like that first investment in 2013. And you have like a those international funds are mostly like focused on Series B. So if I look at Series B, then local money is pretty scarce at that point, right? So a Series B in Brazil would be like a $15 million or something, even like probably something between $10 and $25 million. That would be like a Series B in Brazil. Our Series B was $19 million, as we were saying before. And typically the leaders of those rounds tend to be funds that have no physical presence in the country, but that they know the country for a while, and then they make like selective investments. So in our case, we invited IFC, which is from the World Bank, so the International Finance Corporation, which has like a branch that invests in fintech for the last years. And they are typically leaders in the country and in Latin America in general for this type of Series B rounds. We also attracted Naspers FinTech. It's a new fund from the South African conglomerate. They are also targeting rounds of this size, like $15 to $20 million. And then we also got the participation from the current investors, which are, you know, Redpoint, Casec Ventures, as we were mentioning, Quona Capital, which is a fund based in DC from Acción, and then Kiwi Investors, which is from Nigel Morris, and they are like great investors in fintech. In companies in the U.S. like SoFi, Prosper, Credit Karma, and GreenSky, and so on, right? So I would say, you know, Series B is the point in which you really need an international venture capital or fund that is going to be leading that round, and the local money probably at that point is not getting in anymore. When you have that point, you probably would need to do something like what Nubank did last year, which was like attracting funds like a founders fund from Peter Thiel and the like, or you should probably rely on the private equity, on the local private equity ecosystem, which in that case, private equity is like a good option for tickets, you know, above $50 million or something. But it obviously depends on the cash flow generation capacity of the business that you reach at that point.
Well, one of the funds that you have chosen to go with does have that, you know, history of working kind of in this bridge between venture capital and private equity. Naspers does private equity style deals as well.
Yeah, actually, they, I would say that they are like, in reality, they are like a venture arm of a corporation in reality. So that's what typically Naspers does. So they typically go for, they try to get control of the company and then operate the company itself, right? But what we did was not Naspers directly, it was Naspers FinTech, which is a specific fund that they aim to do VC investing. So they target like, you know, minority stakes similar to the VC type of style. So they want to be close to the ecosystem. They believe that there's like a long-term trend of migration in financial services, and they have like selected 2-3 verticals that are very relevant for them, that are part of their vision for the long term. But they operate as a VC in this type of business, so they don't actually get into the direct management of the company.
And what about exits? So of course, the regional exits have, the biggest one has been Mercado Libre. You've had Globant and a few, just a couple of others, real, you know, exits, and most of them have been exits in the New York Stock Exchange. What is the thinking currently in terms of exits, and are people, is there a Brazilian exit option?
Good. So that's a good question. So the Brazilian ecosystem for startups and technology-driven companies is relatively new. So it started probably, I would say, there are waves, right? But you know, I would say that the first wave was companies that were founded in the late 90s, and the best example of a successful case is Buscapé, which is like a price comparison e-commerce type of thing. It was sold actually to Naspers in reality for $350 million like 6-7 years ago. So that was like a success story, and the founder of that company became a reference for the ecosystem. And actually, he's now a partner at Redpoint in Brazil. Then the second wave was e-commerce, and that was in 2008, 2009, 2010. That was the moment in which that type of companies were founded. Those cases were not didn't experience like great news in terms of exits. So there were not too many exits in that space. So that was probably like a going backwards type of thing. Investors realized that the market had like some complexities, and there were actually not like a lot of buyers looking to buy those type of properties, with certain exceptions. Ultimately, I would say. But looking more recently, what we saw was a set of companies that were created specifically in the financial services industry. One of them is Moip, M-O-I-P. It's a it's a payments gateway. It was sold recently for $100 million. We have like another success story, Zero Paper, which is a SaaS model for small businesses. It was sold to Intuit 2 years ago. And then you have companies that are getting into a size that they are like rethinking about the IPO. I'm thinking about like a couple of them. One is XP Investimentos. It's sort of like a technology company focused in, it will be like the Charles Schwab of Brazil. So they are targeting an IPO that is probably going to value the company at $3 to $4 billion. The other one is Netshoes, which is an e-commerce for sportswear. And probably they will be looking for an IPO in 2017. So it obviously depends on the market, but I think that those type of exits are going to be great news for the ecosystem, and it's going to be the confirmation of an investment
plan. Those last two, do you think they're going to seek exits at the New York Stock Exchange as well, or are they going to look for exits in the Brazilian Stock Exchange?
So that's a good question. I would say probably the type of company that Netshoes is would look at international markets, I guess, versus XP, that it may be like a combination because of the size and the interest on local investors. Actually, XP is already an exit because it's General Atlantic bought like a 49% stake in the company, right? So it already had like some liquidity for certain of the founders. So it's already like a successful case.
Yeah. And if you were to make that decision, whenever that decision is going to cross your path, are you going to choose to exit in Brazil or in the New York Stock Exchange?
So we are not thinking currently on the IPO of the company. I think that we have like a 2 or 3 years of exponential growth that is ahead of us, and this fundraising is going to be enough to actually put the company where we want to. And I think that that's like a discussion for the future. I think it certainly depends on the market conditions in the moment in which you want to the exit transaction, right?
Very good. Very interesting, very enlightening, and it's great to see success stories coming out of Latin America and in particular in your case.